and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. On this episode, we're going to be discussing the film You Might Be the Killer, which is a slasher spoof in the fine, I guess, trope-tracking tradition. I didn't mean to alliterate, but I just did, of Scream and Cabin in the Woods and films of that ilk. It follows a camp counselor who, with the help of a genre-savvy comic book store-owning friend, tries to think his way out of a jam with a psychotic killer at his camp. So, Matt, you want to just start with the synopsis?
Sure. So, we open with, my notes just say, stabbing in the woods, with, you know, ba-dum-chish. Our hero, of sorts, his name is Sam, is on the run from a masked maniac. He takes refuge in a cabin, calls up his friend Chuck, who is a lady who runs a kind of nerd ephemera store, comic books and the like, and he tells her that he is soliciting her advice because she is a real gore hound, a real slasher movie expert, and he has found himself in an IRL slasher scenario, and she's going to help him out of it.
He's been, the movie starts with him just sort of running through the woods and screaming in rather amusing fashion, like off screen mostly.
Yeah, the opening titles are well done. Right away, the movie introduces this motif wherein it shows you a big red kind of drippy Goosebumps font-y on-screen counter showing you how many camp counselors are still alive, which turns out to be very helpful because Sam and Chuck start moving through Sam's memories kind of non-linearly over the course of this phone call as his repressed memories kind of bubble up to the surface. So when that counter comes up, that kind of grounds you temporally in this slasher narrative. We start with a flashback to what seems to be the first day of staff training. We meet, I think, a dozen counselors of varying degrees of likability and importance. The most important one is Sam's on-again, off-again
pretty
sweetheart.
Sure off-again at this point.
More off than on, yeah. Squeeze, a summer fling named Imani. And there's also a character named Steve, otherwise known as the Kayak King.
Almost exclusively known as the Kayak King. In fact,
it's what they're going to etch on his tombstone, almost guaranteed.
Yes, calling him Steve the Kayak King is almost as obligatory as it is for Matt to call Batman v Superman, Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice.
Yes.
So
it is his true appellation, despite the fact that he is in fact
the Canoe King, as he takes pains to point out.
His protests fall on deaf ears. So right away we get kind of a cheeky little scene where Sam is being a little bit of a Luddite about this whole camping excursion. He wants everyone to hand in their phones, go off the grid, man, reconnect with nature. Everyone surrenders their phones, and predictably that leads to trouble down the road. Every slasher movie struggles with the cell phone problem. This is as good a solution as any, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of lampshades it a little bit and also just takes care of it in quick, decisive fashion.
Back to our frame narrative, the killer is dousing the cabin in gasoline and setting it alight. Sam kicks down a wall and escapes. He's talking to Chuck this whole time. They're bantering. The whole tone is very light on its feet. Kind of hesitate to say whimsical, but definitely Chuck in particular is very lackadaisical about the whole situation. She's still dealing with customers and just has a very laissez-faire attitude towards all the bloodshed. This is when we get our first look at our killer. He's a kind of Jason Voorhees type, kind of a hulking brute with a big cleaver and what looked to me at first glance to be a hockey mask that turns out to not be the case, actually. It's kind of like a hewn wood mask.
Yeah, it's like if somebody took off Groot's face.
God, that's grisly.
Sorry.
Now I am Groot.
Without a mouth, just the eyes.
That is more horrifying than anything in the film, actually.
I'm sorry.
it's still me. It's still your pal Groot. It's like, no, I can tell the difference.
You're using words. He gave it away.
We then get another flashback where Steve, the Kayak King, is hung up and butchered. A lot of these murder set pieces are kind of contextless, at least near the beginning. Again, we're getting them all out of order. It's all scrambled. So the movie doesn't dwell on them, any of them, for particularly long. We move into a flashback wherein the counselors are dividing into teams. Defense, offense, they're trying to outwit the killer, lure him into traps. Kevin McAllister, his ass. This is when some wrinkles start emerging in the dialogue between Sam and Chuck. Chuck is asking some kind of hardball questions, I guess you could say. Some discrepancies are coming to light. She point blank asks Sam if he's covered in blood. He says yes. Oh, we've known this from the beginning because we've been watching the film.
We can see him.
We can see his face. And we've also seen the title. So this is not really... I'm glad that they deal with this relatively early on in the proceedings, because the revelation comes about that Sam is in fact the one doing the killing. He has started wearing a mask and adopted a murderous persona, and he is butchering his co-workers. And Chuck basically calls him out on this. It takes him a minute to adjust to the idea, but then he pretty much owns up to it. He's got some kind of dueling personalities, schizophrenia thing going on.
Yeah, basically, whenever he's been murdering people, he's been kind of blacking out. He doesn't ever quite put it in those terms, but when he's talking through things initially with Chuck, he's talking about how, well, you know, I just kind of remember everything being great, and then it turned shitty, and then this happened, and this happened. And there's clearly big gaps, but he never says, like, oh, I don't remember when this was going on, or I blacked out, or whatever. But clearly, yeah, he's having some dissociative issues. And it's around this time that it comes to light that he's not just crazy, strictly speaking. It's that this mask that he's been wearing is cursed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty apparent from the beginning that something is up, because he's having there's this very pronounced ringing on the soundtrack, and like he's getting headaches, and it's very apparent that something is up. We get this backstory kind of exposition dump in the form of another flashback in which all of the counselors are sitting around telling each other campfire stories, and Sam, who has inherited this campground, is that right?
Yes.
It's his show, basically, tells this kind of long, elaborate folktale wherein these woods have always been haunted by an evil presence, and some shaman or medicine man managed to distill that presence into a cursed tree, and then a wood carver came along and chopped down that tree and turned the wood into a mask, and then put on the mask and became possessed and butchered everyone in his village, and then was himself slain by
lone survivor.
Your obligatory final girl.
Old final girl, as the case may be.
Yeah, exactly. He concludes his spooky story, Sam does, and then Amani proposes a treasure hunt of sorts, wherein, you know, none of them were at all put off by his creepy tale. They're going to go into the woods and try to find the woodcarver's grave and dig up the mask, just on a lark, basically, just doing dumb, drunk camp counselor stuff. Basically the kind of antics that got Jason Voorhees drowned.
Yeah, no, exactly. So everybody runs off, and left at the campfire are Sam and this very pure, kind, clearly final girly character named Jamie is there, and she doesn't want to go.
She was the only one who was unsettled by his narrative.
Yeah, and then there's also this girl, Drew, who's in her few appearances in the film, she's kind of flirting with Sam rather a lot, and she's trying to get him to follow her out on this thing, and he, you know, he is susceptible to her charms, even though he's still clearly into Imani, and so he follows Drew into the woods, but loses track of her, gets out to the grave, because, as she pointed out, he's got to know where it is. This is his family's land.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets out there. There's this sort of gnarled stump with a gravestone next to it. Drew pops up behind him and puts hands over his eyes. Guess who?
Yeah, perfunctory kind of fake out jump scare moment.
Yeah. and he's trying to like get her to leave and gather everybody else up and just say, to hell with this. But she's wants to keep playing the game. She goes over the gravestone, and pretty soon she uncovers the mask. It's not buried, really. It's just kind of covered up with some undergrowth or whatever. And she pulls it up and is kind of like waving it at Sam, and he's trying to get her to put it down and cut it out and whatever. And she puts it on his face, and that's what kind of kicks all this off.
Yeah, she's sealed her fate, basically, because then he becomes possessed and kills her. And we've had a couple other killings up till now, although the timeline is all fucked, as I've mentioned. But we've already seen him off a whole bunch of other counselors. He killed a pair of skinny dippers by the pool at this point. He killed a pair of counselors who were raiding the pantry. He killed a pair of deserters. He kills a lot of people in pairs, I noticed, presumably just to speed things along. Because there are 12 of them for him to chew his way through. This is where he rushes a group of survivors who have been busily digging pits and filling them with sharpened stakes, spikes. He jumps over the pit, I guess because in some subconscious vestigial part of his brain, he knows that, I don't know, it's unclear how much of Sam's consciousness is in there. You get a lot of like Smeagol, Gollum moments where he's kind of wrestling with the evil entity, as it were, but it seems like the mask or the presence or whatever it is was cognizant of the fact that a trap was being set for him and just jumped right over the pit.
Yeah, I get the sense that regardless of the battle of wills that occasionally goes on in his head, the entity trapped inside the mask at least has access to Sam's knowledge.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's kind of a one-way street.
Kind of knows what Sam knows.
So Sam, after a momentary battle of wills, throws Imani into the pit. She is presumed dead. Neither Jim nor I were fooled. Let the record show. He's still talking to Chuck. The movie is kind of, there's a little bit of a tonal shift here where things start getting a little more dire. It felt to me like it's become apparent at this point. Chuck is really heavily invested in this kind of stock slasher storytelling wherein the killer is always killed in turn by the final girl, who is always the most innocent, virginal, would-be victim out of the cast of characters. And she's really trying to impress upon Sam that he's doomed.
Yeah, like, sorry, bro, you gotta die, and Jamie's gonna kill you.
Yeah.
Jamie is clearly the final girl by virtue of all the tropes.
Right, exactly.
There's also kind of an interesting period in this sort of transitional section where Sam is on the run from, I believe it's Jamie, and then this guy, Brad, who's, you know, this sort of big hulking dude, kind of a beefy guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of turning the slasher trope on its head in the sense that the slasher is running away from his would-be victims.
Yeah, right, exactly. That was kind of amusing. It turns into like a penitent Michael Myers story where like he's being hunted by Dr. Loomis and is kind of, yeah, it flips the whole cat mouse thing on its head in kind of a clever way.
Yeah, he very desperately wants to be like, "Hey, no, I didn't do this. I can explain," but he knows that if he stops to explain, he's fucking toast.
Right, exactly.
So,
he proceeds to continue to struggle with the mask. It goes on, it goes off. He has already at this point tried to dispose of it once. He tried to burn it, and in so doing
started burning his face.
Magically, yeah, singed his cheek because he and the mask are now symbiotically linked somehow.
Which Chuck takes completely in stride. She's just like, oh yeah, it must have imprinted on you.
Yeah, she's pulling up a bunch of like scrapbooks from the vault, you know, from the storage closet in the back of this comic book store.
It's like a D-list Necronomicons.
Yeah, that's just printed on parchment as opposed to flesh. Therefore a little less imposing. Anyway, in relatively short order, the buff jock dude, whose name escapes me,
Brad,
is dealt with, that is to say killed, leaving just Jamie, the final girl, until, surprise, Imani reemerges, somewhat anticlimactically, I thought. She just kind of like steps into frame, which could have been funny, but it didn't feel like it was really, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it wasn't really played for laughs or effectively for shock. It was, mm-hmm.
It just sort of happened.
It was weird.
Yeah, this movie has a weird, I mean, part of it is right there in the title, You Might Be the Killer. You know, it's almost, it plays its hand really early in a couple different places. And to a degree, I think that's sort of a fun tongue-in-cheek thing because these tropes are kind of old as the hills at this point. But yeah, that was one moment that sort of threw me. Imani and Jamie lock themselves in a tool shed. They're kind of having a Goldilocks moment where they're trying to pick out their preferred weapon. You know, this one's too heavy, this one's too long, etc. And Sam descends upon them. They manage to lock him in the tool shed. They brain him with a shovel, Jamie does, knocking the mask to the ground. And what then ensues is a kind of bizarrely long scene in which he's pleading his innocence, saying, "It wasn't me, man, it was the mask." So he tells them a bunch of stuff we already know. And then he calls Chuck, who takes a while to pick up the phone, just kind of dragging things out further. And then she basically repeats everything that he just said. So we're getting all this information for the third, if not the fourth time. And the whole thing is just kind of strained and peculiar. I don't know. We'll touch on this more after the break.
Just for the moment, though, the strange thing about it for me, besides the length, was the fact that Jamie and Imani are like clearly incredulous about his claim.
Rightfully
that the mask
so,
did
yeah.
it. And yet they're also like oddly willing to hear him out.
Yes.
I didn't know how to feel about
they're
that.
Extremely accommodating under the circumstances. And then they treat Chuck like just a fountain of wisdom, just like a faultless teller of truths, which is, you know, her function in the movie, I guess. But yeah, they go along with it.
She does at one point, again, you know, lampshading it, kind of funny, say that exposition is her middle name.
Right.
So, uh-huh. Yeah.
I was kind of surprised that she wasn't billed that way in the credits. That would have been sort of funny. Although, come to think of it, I'm not sure that they even gave her a surname.
Yeah, so. No, they didn't. So it wouldn't really have worked.
They would have had to shoehorn one in there. Anyway, what then happens is that Sam unsurprisingly puts the mask back on, gets his berserker strength back, and busts out of the tool shed. Imani and Jamie head for the hills, and then they get into a conceptually interesting and funny, but in execution kind of odd, catfight standoff thing where they are basically taking Chuck's word as gospel at this point, which means that there can only be one final girl, which means they need to duke it out to decide which one gets the right to kill the killer and therefore survive.
Yeah, basically Imani starts off by kind of doing the heel turn, wheeling around and being like, okay, I have to kill you, basically.
Right.
And first after
grilling her, yeah.
Yeah, first she's trying to justify that, like, well, you don't necessarily need to be the final girl. You're not as pure as you make out,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you're
like,
not so innocent.
Like, you party, right? You, like, drink or do drugs, at least caffeine, right? Jamie's just like, well, no. Well, you're not even a virgin, are you? That's personal. Well, are you or not? And then Jamie's like, yeah. And then everybody's like, well, fuck it, I still have to kill you.
Yeah, it's like, I'm pretty sure even Laurie Strode drank caffeine in some of those late-night studying sessions that she was liable to do.
Yeah.
Come on.
So after this argument basically reaches its conclusion, Jamie pulls a fast one and clocks Imani in the face with the shovel, just like she did to Sam, and straight fucking murders her.
Yep.
That threw me for a loop. Like, yeah. Not a lot in this movie necessarily surprised me, but that kind of did.
Yeah, put that in your final girl pipe and smoke it.
Knocks her down and then, like, literally drives the shovel through her face, I think, two or three times.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so then she just turns around and Sam's there in the mask and
she's going to stand her ground and fight him, but Chuck, who is
still on speakerphone,
just lying amidst the leaves, is shouting at her to, like, no, you have to, something like, you have to kill him at a site that has mystic significance. Like, basically, the long and the short of it is that their final standoff has to happen at the woodcarver's grave.
I think the term she uses is place of power.
Sure. So that's where they end up. Sam has one final battle with the spirit of the mask, takes it off.
We shouldn't neglect the fact that he takes his skull machete knife thing and shoves it between his face and the mask, cuts himself a little bit in the course of prying this mask off. So it is a little bit fucking metal of him.
Yeah, and then he proceeds to successfully rip off that Band-Aid, as it were, and reassert control. He's acting very much like kind of a Smeagoly character who could succumb to his darker impulses at any moment. But he makes it to the gravesite, says, "Look, Jamie, bury this thing." Jamie's credentials as a digger of pits has been well established at this point. It's marveled at several times throughout the movie that she's very proficient when it comes to she dug all the pits with the sharpened stakes in them earlier. So she digs into the woodcarver's grave, is preparing to bury the mask. There's all this rigmarole about how Sam doesn't want to touch it, doesn't even want to look at it, doesn't think she should touch it or look at it. Sure enough, she does both. And then she puts it on and becomes possessed and kills Sam.
Yeah, then she takes the mask off. I can't remember if she calls Chuck or if Chuck is calling Sam's phone, but either way, talks to Chuck.
I don't know why anyone ever hangs up on Chuck. They always just call back.
Right, exactly.
It's just a waste of time.
But yeah, talks to Chuck. Chuck, of course, expects it to be Sam, and instead Jamie just says, "Chuck, I finished it," and hangs up. And then just kind of spookily walks off into the distance.
Yeah, so for a second it looks like the movie is going to end on kind of a downer, kind of with a little bit of a harder edge than you would have expected. But instead, it does sort of a U-turn tonal course correction at the very last minute, which I thought was funny.
Yeah, so as this kind of spooky final note is happening and Jamie is carrying the mask off into the evil-looking sunset, suddenly we get a smash cut into a title card of 2 years later, and Chuck is at her store and picks up the ringing phone, and we just hear Sam say, "Chuck!" Because there's this sort of throwaway gag in the first half hour or so of the film when Chuck is giving Sam the whole exposition dump of how this all works, and she says at one point, "Well, you know, worst case scenario, a lot of these movies, the killer comes back in a couple of years, like lightning strikes his grave and whatnot, so you got that to look forward to."
Yeah, that's supposed to be the silver lining.
Yeah, and Sam's just like, "That's not funny, fuck you."
Turns out it is funny, because that's exactly what happens. And then the counter, the dead counselor counter, ticks back up to one, but it says undead counselors or something like that.
Yeah, it says undead counselors, yeah. Where it used to say just dead counselors.
You get the idea. And she seems pleased to hear from him. Roll credits.
Yep. So, yeah, that's You Might Be the Killer. We're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
Maybe you could help me out.
Being responsible for an entire summer camp.
Nature's our nature.
What could possibly go wrong?
Everything started out so great,
and now there's this crazed killer roaming the campground.
Wait, really?
Hey guys, Jim here during the break to let you in on some ways you can help support our podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Got an idea for the next movie you'd like us to fix? Feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Sam?
I hate to ask you this, but are you sure you're not the killer?
And we're back. So, Matt, what do you got for us?
Well, I hate to open on a note of horror geek pedantry, but there's a massively irritating scene where Chuck is explaining to Sam how he's going to meet his maker, basically that he's going to be done in by the final girl. She says, "It always happens this way. The final girl is always the virgin, the sweet, innocent girl next door type, and she always kills the killer." And then she proceeds to list three examples. She name drops three classic slasher movies, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in which that does not happen. Like, Freddy Krueger wins pretty definitively in the first Nightmare on Elm Street on the basis of that final scene, and Michael Myers and Leatherface both survive the events of their first movies, too. They are 100% okay when it cuts to black.
Yeah, Michael Myers at least has to run away, but Leatherface is just there and would have killed her if she had not gotten on the truck.
Yeah, he's just having a party. He's just
doing a dance in
doing
the street.
His, yeah, yeah, right. On the road. Doing his little chainsaw duet. Yeah, it's really weird because they set her up as such an aficionado of the genre, but then that line feels like it was written by someone doing a cursory glance at Wikipedia. You know, I feel like the movie does, or Chuck specifically, does occasionally throw some deep cuts out there. Like, she references Maniac Cop at one point, which is a movie I haven't even seen. I've seen Maniac, but not Maniac Cop. I think those are both William Lustig movie. Anyway.
But I don't think they have anything to do with one another.
No, I don't think they do. So it doesn't help me none. But yeah, those deep cuts don't stick around that much. Like, she's not actually a treasure trove of genre savvy knowledge. She ends up falling back on pretty tried and true genre landmarks pretty quickly, and it undermines the point she's trying to make. That's the real issue, not that she's like insufficiently snobby for my liking or not. I don't know, that just didn't work for me at all.
Yeah, no, her using those three examples to illustrate that point is kind of the equivalent of Glass's mother in Glass talking about comic book tropes and clearly not really understanding them.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong.
Just a callback to that not very good movie. And speaking of tropes that are sort of, I don't know, inaccurately applied, just to really lay on the pedantry real hard, when Jamie sort of surprises us and kills the fuck out of Imani, the first thing I said after that happened, besides, like, holy fuck, was I looked over to Matt and I said, well, wait, doesn't that kind of, like, ruin her purity? How could she be a final girl now? And I guess maybe that works with the way the movie ends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe her killing somebody is what sets her up to be vulnerable to the mask. I don't know, but that sort of complicates the trope dissection.
Right.
More than maybe the movie intended. I don't know.
Yeah, it feels like they just had, they being the filmmakers, you know, screenwriter, whoever, had an idea for a scene wherein two prospective final girls would have to have a battle royale. And that idea just seemed really funny. But in practice, it's not as funny as it sounds. And that's true of some other things. But that scene specifically, I just feel like that, like, even a way broader, dumber satire treatment of that scene might have even made it work better. Like, I feel like one of the old scary movies could have done more with that idea than this movie does with it, just because this movie plays it a little too straight. And it's weird because, like, the first half of this is pretty broad comedy, but as it goes on, a little bit of that falls by the wayside for me, I think. Which might all just be, I don't know. I kind of wish that it had gone all the way with that. Because I have other issues with the way that the climax plays out. Namely, that the camera dwells too long on Jamie staring down at this mask, and you hear the same sinister whispers that you've been hearing the whole movie every time Sam is tempted to put the mask on. You know, the voice of Sauron, basically. And so you know exactly what's going to happen. And they could have staged this really differently, because this whole time Sam has his back turned to the hole that Jamie is digging, because he doesn't want to see the mask. He doesn't want to succumb to temptation. So he has no idea what's happening. But the scene is grounded in Jamie's perspective, which robs it of a lot of suspense. Like, you see her put the mask on, stand up, approach Sam. He slowly turns around and then gets a machete in the gut. I feel like it would have been interesting if this movie had done, like, in my head, this could have played out in much more of, like, a James Wan kind of way. Far be it for me to hold that up as, like, an example of something I'd like to see more of. But in this context, that could have been really unexpected and actually alarming in a way that the jump scares are not alarming in your run-of-the-mill Conjuring installment. because you're not expecting a movie with this kind of comic atmosphere to end on a note of actual startling suspense. You know, like if the whole thing had been from Sam's perspective, where it's just like tied in on his face and he's like, okay, just whistle or whatever, give me a sign when you've filled in the hole and then I'll turn around and we can get out of here. There's this whole spiel that he gives in the movie that you, I don't know. I would have liked to see, if the movie was starting to take itself more seriously, I just would have liked to see it go all the way with that, yeah. I guess. And it would have made the final scene even funnier and more of a breath of fresh air, because you, at that point, wouldn't be expecting it to end on that kind of note.
Yeah. I guess the comparison I would make, again, sort of to the disservice of this film in preference to a different film, is Shaun of the Dead, which is about as broad comedy as it gets for the first 80 minutes of the film. But then, you know, as it's reaching the climax and people are getting fucking dragged out of the Winchester and eaten or what have you, the movie does get pretty much straight horror. And it doesn't get horror in the sense that there's a whole shit ton of suspense or anything, but it definitely sort of completes the transition. And then obviously, spoiler alert, for people who haven't seen Shaun of the fucking Dead, get off your ass. But then it goes immediately back to the broad comedy with Simon Pegg out with zombie Nick Frost in the shed playing video games.
Yeah, with the Queen song playing.
Exactly. Yeah.
After this past year, I feel like I'm done with Queen for a little while, but that ending still gets me.
Sure. So yeah, movies, even horror comedies, do often handle this transition. It is possible to do it. And again, it's not as though You Might Be the Killer completely fails at this task, because as Matt was saying, that second to last moment, that is, of Jamie sort of walking off into this creepy sunset carrying the mask, it's moody, it's creepy. But yeah, I think you're completely right that if they had framed the lead up to Sam's death a little bit differently and really worked the suspense a little harder, the whole thing would have been a lot more effective.
That last, or penultimate, I guess, scene of Jamie wandering off into the backwoods is kind of interesting, and they could have done a lot more with that image and that idea, because it's like watching a version of the end of Texas Chainsaw where Sally and Leatherface are the same person in a way. Because it's like, as in Chainsaw, she's like headed off into the sunset, basically. It's that ending does a lot of, I don't know, the like turning the final girl into the killer is an amusing notion, but it doesn't really, that's kind of where it begins and ends.
Yeah.
There are some pretty indisputable genre pleasures to be found here. There's one particularly satisfying head cloven in two moment by the poolside that's really gushy and splattery.
Yeah, and this is relatively early on, and this is the first sign that we get that this movie has that sort of thing in it.
Yes.
It completely took me by surprise, certainly. Just it's the two skinny dippers, the second and third murders Sam, who I don't believe we quite know is Sam at that point.
I'm not sure. It doesn't really matter. Yeah.
The killer just shows up, and this guy is kind of like, what are you doing perving out over there, you creepy guy, whatever. And then just shot from the back of the guy's head, shoulders up, and just, yeah, fucking big-ass gap. It's not even like a machete, like, buries all the way down in the guy's head, but it's still like together, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally like big ass chasm in the middle of the dude's head.
Yeah, his head splits open like John Carpenter's The Thing. It's something to behold. It's not like what you'd imagine from like stabbing a pumpkin or whatever. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Something else I appreciate that's kind of a genre thing about it. Matt's already talked about the death counter, basically, but something, just kind of a small thing about that, and about kind of like the opening titles too, that I like.
Oh, the grain.
They do the grain, yeah. Like grindhousey sort of thing, like 70s throwback horror, which I appreciated.
Sure.
It's just It's not like whole swaths of the movie have digital grain added in. It's really just these interstitial bits, but it just gives that little bit of flavor to it.
You know, that always takes me to my happy place, for sure. There are some moments where it feels like the actors, who are all, you know, across the board, very capable and occasionally very funny. But there are moments, especially more and more as the film goes on, where it seems like they don't really know how to play it. The film is kind of stranded between these two poles of horror and comedy, where it's sort of, I don't know. I've complained about this already, but it's reflected in the performances, and it's particularly an issue in that scene I've already complained about, where Sam is locked in the tool shed, and it's just a little bit interminable. And I don't know, it bleeds down into the bedrock of the movie, and like it as I said, affects the performances. The whole thing just doesn't really gel.
Yeah, it manifests in part in what I was talking about earlier, where the two women are clearly incredulous about the idea that the mask is totally responsible, and yet they're perfectly willing to stand there and listen to him talk about it at length, and then get someone else on the phone to talk about it at further length.
Right, someone like, they've never met.
Basically, until you just kind of forget about the fact that they're doing this and how weird it is. For a while, it sort of hits you that the only reason they're standing there is because it is required by the plot, by the script. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any logical sense. Either one or both of these women has a inborn reason to believe in Sam, or they should not be listening to him and should leave immediately. Now, that would be frustrating in a sort of genre exhaustion sense, if you get what I'm saying, in that we as viewers know what he's trying to explain, and we've seen this happen before, where I need to explain something, but the other characters won't let me explain it to them, and damn it.
I mean, yeah, that's always a pain in the ass. I've complained about that more than once on this program.
But that still would have made a little bit more sense, I think, than what ends up happening, where, again, they just sort of, their immediate reaction is like, you're fucking crazy, and yet they stand there.
Right.
And I don't really get it. Now, they could have just played that for laughs, which would have made a lot of sense. Like, you're crazy. Please explain to us your crazy fucking idea. You know, but they don't do that.
Because they do kind of have him at their mercy. But yeah, it's weird. I think you're saying that makes me think that this could have played out in a much funnier way if Amani and Jamie had acted like real people in this scenario, and the point and the object of the satire had been that Sam and Chuck are just way too deep in their nerd bullshit. And that's why they care so much about the lore and about the tropes and all of that. And I kind of thought that the point of all of this was eventually going to be that Chuck's slavish devotion to slasher movie formulas has been getting people killed needlessly. That none of that is actually happening, that Sam has actually just cracked, that it's not magic. And that can't be the case, really. I mean, they could have maybe wiggled out of it somehow, but there's only one instance of indisputable supernatural stuff in the movie, and that's when he tries to burn the mask, and in so doing, burns his face. I feel like if you'd just taken that out, just like chopped it out of the movie with a big old cleaver, that there would have been at least like a touch, just a smattering of ambiguity that would have made some of the "no, I'm innocent, please, you gotta like, listen to me" stuff.
Maybe this is just schizophrenia. Or,
yeah,
you know,
which is another
whatever,
another slasher cliche. But that would have made his wrong man routine a little bit easier to sit through.
Yeah, this brings me back around to something that I've been thinking about here the last few minutes, and originally I was thinking maybe I should have just opened with this, that would have made more sense, but this actually kind of segues in. My initial expectation going into this movie about what this movie was going to be was you might be the killer, and then we spend at least a significant portion of the film trying to determine whether Sam is actually the killer. as opposed to dispensing with it in the first 15 minutes as the movie does. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily wrong that they didn't do that. I think the direction they went in, despite its flaws, is mostly fine. But it did sort of leave by the wayside the movie I anticipated and a movie I might have liked if they had done it right, where there's, again, it's just a lot of ambiguity, almost like a fucking Memento style, trying to track down what the hell the truth is through his shattered memory. And yeah, maybe he's just mentally ill and he's trying to sort out his fucking life, as opposed to, okay, well, no, it's this cursed mask that is giving him blackouts. And I think a testament to the degree to which I was sort of invested in this idea of the direction the movie was going to go into that it did not at all really go into is that even after it's pretty conclusively revealed that Sam is the killer, I said to Matt, okay, well, now the twist has to be that he's not actually the killer after all.
Right, that he's been, that it's a frame job somehow.
They've thrown out the central conceit, or what I thought the central conceit of the film was in the first 15, 20 minutes. They've got to turn it back around. And really, no, it is just this sort of trope dissection. And again, probably my favorite part in sort of the middle of the film is when it's the reversal of the cat and mouse, where the killer is fleeing the would-be victims.
Yeah, that was good fun.
So I don't know if this movie will ever get made. Presumably it'll get made by someone, because every version of the slasher film either has been made or will be made at some point or another.
Yeah.
But I did kind of want to see, and would like to see at some point, a sort of am I not the murderer sort of deconstructed slasher film.
Yeah, I would watch that movie. I feel like it would have been a mistake for the filmmakers to save the Sam is a killer reveal for like the third act, because of what the title is, because then you would get there and the audience would go, yeah, no duh, we know, that's why we clicked on this movie on Shudder or Amazon or wherever else.
Yeah.
But I figured when it came about relatively early on that Sam was pretty much definitely the killer, I figured one of two things would happen. Neither of them did. A, I thought that, yes, Sam is the killer, but for reasons that have nothing to do with the mask. He has some other kind of psychopathy going on, and the mask is just an extension of that, or it's a smoke screen somehow. Or B, the mask is super duper haunted, but it was somehow foisted upon him in a way that makes him still kind of the fall guy in that frame job kind of way that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. I thought for a little while that maybe it was going to be revealed that Chuck was some kind of mastermind doing, because like there's a couple lines where there's one line in particular actually where she says she's trying to do a tally of who's alive and who isn't among Sam's coworkers, and she very pointedly asks, what about Imani? How's she doing? In a way that was seemed like it was dripping with foreshadowing, but actually wasn't. I think that she just phrases it gingerly because she know that Imani means a lot to Sam.
Yeah.
In retrospect, that's a likelier explanation. I thought that there was going to be some kind of woman scorned thing there where Chuck was like animated by jealousy or whatever. Because she knows so much about all this voodoo bullshit that like, oh yeah, you and the mask are linked now, or whatever the nomenclature is.
The mask has imprinted on you.
Imprinted, yeah, like a baby bird. Thank you. She's so knowledgeable that it feels like, okay, obviously she had a hand in this somehow. Turns out that's not the case. So whatever, I've failed to outwit the movie. That's fine. Happens all the time. I just feel like both of those hypothetical scenarios, particularly the first one wherein Sam is actually just a lunatic, could have made the movie a little bit more interesting, at least in the last 20-odd minutes or so. And the fun thing about surprise killer reveals is that you can invent crazy, ridiculous, traumatic backstories for them, even if it comes out of fucking nowhere. You know, like one of my favorite slasher movies, and spoilers, seriously, turn me off if you haven't seen Sleepaway Camp.
Do not listen any further.
Sleepaway Camp,
because you cannot
rules.
Let this be ruined.
Oh, that movie owns. So yeah, that settles on a very unlikely killer and inverts the whole final girl thing in a way cleverer way than what this movie does.
Let me tell you, sweet Christ, the final shot of Sleepaway Camp fucked my shit up.
Yeah, there's going to be some sleepless nights after that one for sure. The movie earns that ending because when it delves into the killer's backstory and why they are the way they are, it is just buck wild enough that you find yourself going along with it. It's problematic, you know, it hasn't aged super duper but whatever, it's a great movie. I stand by it. I think that sleazy grindhouse stuff has sort of a little bit more leeway with that in my mind. Your mileage may vary, but yeah, no, Sleepaway Camp 10 out of 10 for Matt Gerandese. I feel like that's the kind of gold standard for me when it comes to that kind of twist. And You Might Be the Killer just doesn't have it. That's fine. Most slasher movies are not operating on that level.
I'm sorry. I just keep thinking about fucking Sleepaway Camp now.
Yeah, no.
Seriously. No, yeah. Like, the Matt can attest, he had seen the movie before. I was watching it with him for the first time at his insistence, and I definitely don't regret it, but I was shook.
Yeah, it's like, blood-curdling. Like, it makes you want to, like, wriggle out of your own skin and run down the street just like a bunch of jangling bones, like a cartoon skeleton, like heading for the horizon. It really does make you want to just turn tail and run away from the screen. I'm overselling it at this point, because how could I not be? Maybe people more jaded than myself won't be as taken in by it. But yeah, no, Sleepaway Camp. Anyway, that concludes our review of Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah.
But, you know, You Might Be the Killer is largely fun. It is better than I thought it would be based on the title, which has the air of a slasher-themed Jeff Foxworthy punchline.
You might be the killer if...
If you wake up covered in blood next to the desiccated remains of your coworker, you might be the killer. Which reminds me, on the subject of desiccated remains, the reason I harped on about the chemistry between the actors not working in the last 10, 15, 20 minutes of the movie is that it does work earlier. So there's something to contrast it with. Like, there's a particularly funny scene where they're all arrayed around the dangling corpse of Steve, the kayak king. And Sam is so shaken that, like, every time they refer to, you know, oh, somebody killed Steve, Sam goes, oh, the kayak king. He's like so beside himself with grief, and that's the only way he knows how to eulogize him. It was like everyone plays off of each other really well during most of those flashbacks, and then it just, that feeling of camaraderie, well, camaraderie isn't exactly the right word, because they do end up at each other's throats, Amani and Jamie and whoever else, but that frisson of I don't know, something or other, chemistry, it just sort of goes missing.
Yeah. Well, this has been our review of You Might Be the Killer. Overall, solid, good fun. It's under 90 minutes, so it's not a big commitment. I think we'd overall recommend it.
Yeah, if they make a second one that actually follows through on the promise of the Friday the 13th Part 6 Jason Lives thing, where Sam is actually a reanimated corpse, that could be good fun. I would watch that for sure, even though I don't really think the ending of this one sets that up as well as it could have, because he's not the killer when he dies. Jamie is, so that's whatever, more horror geek pedantry. That's not the note I want to end on. He's Jim Smith.
And he's Matt Gerandese. We are the Shock Doctors, and we will see you next time.
Watch Sleepaway Camp.
Sleepaway Camp.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from You Might Be the Killer, official U.S. trailer, uploaded by Screen Media Films. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, April 7th, and we'll be discussing Jordan Peele's Get Out follow-up, Us. See you then.